intimate portrait of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
He suffered tremendously from doubt, and he suffered terribly from the effects of the FBI assault on him. You know, he kept doing his work. He kept marching forward. He kept going, you know, more and more boldly into the breach. But it had an impact. You know, he was hospitalized several times, maybe, like, fair to say, many times, for exhaustion, for just, you know, succumbing to the stress of what he was doing. So that kind of courage in the face of doubt, to me, makes him even more heroic. There were so many contradictions. He was a protest leader who hated confrontation. He hated being in conflict with the people around him, including his father, including his wife. He was, you know, one of the most moral people I've ever encountered, and yet he was, you know, hopelessly immoral when it came to his marital fidelity. So those complexities are part of what made him so much so interesting and so human for me.
That's Jonathan Eig. We spend the hour with him talking about his acclaimed new biography, King, A Life. This is Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. There have been many books written about Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., but the one just published by Jonathan Eig stands out, not only for the new material Eig reveals, but for the intimacy of his portrait of the famed civil rights leader. We learn about Dr. King's upbringing, his initial reluctance to become a preacher like his father, the moment he recognized that, as he thought of it, God had chosen his path to service in the movement for racial justice. We learn in detail about the implacable persecution of King by J. Edgar Hoover's FBI. Eig tells stories about King's speeches that bring a deeper understanding and appreciation of them to the reader. We learn also about King's deep flaws as a man and a husband, his sexism and discounting of women's leadership in the civil rights movement, his tendency to plagiarize the words of others in his writings. Also, King's profound courage in the face of unrelenting attacks and his undying faith in humanity. It all comes together in a spellbinding story written by a master storyteller. Jonathan Eig is the author of 6 books, including a biography of Muhammad Ali. Jonathan Eig, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thanks for having me.
This book, King, A Life, is such an intimate portrait of King's life. I felt like I was a fly on the wall. I mean, it was absolutely riveting. There have been a lot of books written about Martin Luther King Jr. So first, why were you moved to write this one? And then I'm going to ask you to just talk about the new material, the sources that you used. But first, why were you moved to write this?
Well, you said the magic word for me, which is intimate. I felt like the King books, first of all, there hadn't been a King biography in 35 years when I began this project. It's now over 40 years. And the books that have really riveted me, books like, you know, the Taylor Branch trilogy and the David Garrow book, Bearing the Cross, they weren't intimate in that way because there's these giant histories and that encompass much more than just King's life. So I set out to write something that felt more intimate. So I'm glad that that was the word you chose. But the more immediate reason that I began is that I was interviewing people for my Muhammad Ali book now 10 years ago that I was doing these interviews. And I realized these were a lot of people who knew Martin Luther King Jr. And I just started asking out of curiosity, what was he like? What was it like to be around the man? Because I felt like I really had no clue, having, you know, grown up in an age when we've turned him into a monument and a national holiday. And sometimes it feels like we've turned him into a Hallmark card. I really wanted to get a sense for what he was like as a person. And then to put that story in context and to return some of the teeth to his personality. You know, he's been defanged along the way. And I really wanted to remind people just how radical and how brave he was, too.
Yes. And that's one of the things that I think is so important about this book. He was a very complex man. And maybe just briefly, because we'll revisit this, I think, throughout this conversation, what were some of things that struck you most about his complexity, about some of his contradictions?
Well, so many things. For one thing, he suffered tremendously from doubt, and he suffered terribly from the effects of the FBI assault on him. You know, he kept doing his work. He kept marching forward. He kept going, you know, more and more boldly into the breach. But it had an impact. You know, he was hospitalized several times, maybe like fair to say many times, for exhaustion, for just, you know, succumbing to the stress of what he was doing. So that kind of courage in the face of doubt, to me, makes him even more heroic. There were so many contradictions. He was a protest leader who hated confrontation. He hated being in conflict with the people around him, including his father, including his wife. He was, you know, one of the most moral people I've ever encountered. And yet he was, you know, hopelessly immoral when it came to marital fidelity. So those complexities are part of what made him so much so interesting and so human for me.
And then tell us something about the new material that you worked with and the sources that you used.
Well, the first important source was live witnesses. As I mentioned, you know, there were dozens of people who knew King well, still around when I began this work. Unfortunately, quite a few of them have passed away, but I began just canvassing the country, trying to find people who knew King and doing those interviews in person most of the time before COVID hit, and then over the phone. But in addition to that, there was a lot of new archival material. You know, the FBI has recently released or declassified tons of documents. I found new papers that had never been seen before in the LBJ archives that were highly sensitive. And then there were archives that had been, you know, newly released. You know, the SCLC had an official historian, a guy named L.D. Reddick, who traveled with King everywhere and took notes on every meeting. And his papers were just recently donated and opened up at the Schomburg Library in Harlem. And I believe I was the first person to open those boxes, or at least, you know, most of those boxes. There were endless discoveries to be made. And I was really pleasantly surprised at just how much new material I found.
And there is still at least one big box that is not going to be opened until 2027.
Yes, the FBI has not released the audio recordings of its wiretaps of King. And those will be very important, and they are scheduled to be released in 2027. We have transcripts of many of the wiretaps, and they're very revealing, and they are believed by almost everyone to be accurate, because I talked to people whose voices were heard on those tapes, including Andrew Young, including Harry Belafonte, including people like Bayard Rustin, who before he passed away said that the FBI transcripts were 100% accurate in his opinion. So that is important. But until we hear the voices, until we hear the audio, there's still room for doubt about what the FBI was reporting on King.
Do you expect to delve into them when they're opened?
Oh, I'll be the first in line to, or the first one clipping to try to listen to them if they are released as promised in 27. There's still some people. There are still people hoping to prevent that. But that's neither here nor there as far as I'm concerned. I'll be listening if they're released.
So now tell us a little bit about his family. You mentioned his father. His father was larger than life in many ways. He was also a preacher. Tell us about him and their relationship.
Martin Luther King Sr., or Daddy King, as most people called him, is one of the great heroes of American history, I think. And we should be writing operas about him or something, because he is the classic version of the American dream, only, you know, the particular version of the American dream for people of whose ancestors were enslaved, because Daddy King grows up as a sharecropper. His father was born into slavery. So that's Martin Luther King Jr.'s grandfather. And they're sharecropping in a town called Stockbridge, 20 miles outside of Atlanta. And under typically horrendous conditions, you know, they are made to work with almost no chance of gaining a profit, and absolutely no chance of ever owning that land. And Daddy King's father is driven to drinking and acting violently, beating his children, beating his wife. And Daddy King, at the age of about 12, just decides to leave, walks to Atlanta, and starts working at a rail yard and educating himself, because the schooling in Stockbridge was minimal. He was almost illiterate. And he, you know, in the span of, you know, just a few years, elevates himself from cotton farming to preacher at one of the big Baptist churches in Atlanta, and really gets a foothold in the American dream and makes it possible for Martin Luther King Jr. to be Martin Luther King Jr. It's really a remarkable story. But the conflict between Daddy King and ML, as he called his son, is fascinating to me, because Martin Luther King clearly wants to please his father at all terms, but he also fears him and doesn't want to turn out like his father. In many ways, it's you know, typical rebellion that you see of a son wanting to be better, wanting to be bigger, wanting to be stronger and smarter and more sophisticated than his father, and yet also desperate to please the old man.
Right. And now, I don't want to leave his mother out. She was a very strong woman. Is that right?
Yes. And that was one of Daddy King's greatest moves, is finding this more educated, more established, you know, more financially stable bride. Some people accused him of marrying to get a foothold on the next rung of the economic ladder and also the next social ladder too, because Alberta King was a formidable intellect. She was in school. Her father was the pastor, the preacher at Ebenezer Baptist. So she was a really smart, funny, warm, loving person. A lot of people said that, Daddy King even said this himself, that ML got his warmth and his love of people and his charisma from his mother, and he got his ferocity and his, you know, determination from his father.
Now, why did Martin Luther King Jr. become a preacher? Because this was not something that was preordained, so to speak.
Right. He wrestled with that. When he entered Morehouse, and he entered, he was 2 years younger than most of his classmates, because he'd skipped some grades, he thought he wanted to be a lawyer, probably, or maybe even a doctor. He wanted to do good for his people. That was always one of his goals. But he resisted the call of the church at first. But, you know, he was so steeped in it. He grew up, you know, not just going to church every Sunday, but really being in church almost every day and having people from the church over for dinner every day. And, you know, probably learned to read prayers and to memorize prayers before he learned to read, actually. I think the fact that it was his father's line of work, that it was the family business, and the fact that it offered a kind of an escape from the Jim Crow South. It offered a kind of an escape from a lot of the bounds of this white supremacist culture in which he was raised, because preachers had a measure of independence. They ran their own churches. They didn't depend on the white man for their salaries. And they had literally, you know, a podium from which to speak and to be heard. And all of that appealed to King. You know, being a doctor or a lawyer would have allowed him some a capacity to fight the system, but being a preacher offered a much more direct way of reaching the masses and moving people, and I think that really appealed to him.
And you know, he at one point later on in his life, he pointed to his wife Coretta King as the person who actually got him involved in political activism. Is that a true assessment?
That's absolutely right. You know, Martin was was always popular with the ladies, even though he was, you know, he was short. He wasn't, you know, he was a handsome man, but not, you know, stunningly handsome. But he had this great charm and he never lacked for dates. And when he met Coretta in Boston, when they were both in school, he had other women that he was seeing at the same time. And I think it's worth asking. It's important to ask why Coretta. And the answer, as best I can tell, there's obviously many reasons, but one of the big ones is that she had more experience as an activist than he did at that point. She had gone to Antioch College. She had been involved in protests there. She had been active with political parties, the Progressive Party in particular. So King was deeply attracted to the fact that this woman burned with the same kind of ambition, not just to change, not just to be involved in the movement, but to be on the front lines. And I think it was a great intellectual match in that way.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Jonathan Eig about his biography of King, Martin Luther King, King, A Life. Now, this book is also of course, a lot about the civil rights movement because the two are inextricable, the life of King and that movement. So you delve into some of the stories of other figures like Rosa Parks. So just to digress for a minute to her, I was interested to read that the earliest interview, which actually has just been discovered, the earliest interview about her refusing to give up her seat on the bus in Montgomery was different from the myth. So tell us about that.
This was fascinating to me, and it was one of my favorite archival discoveries. When the Montgomery bus boycott began, a group of sociologists from Fisk University went down to Montgomery and started documenting it without any clear purpose, just recognizing that something important was happening here and that someone should make a record. So these sociologists, black and white, began attending meetings, interviewing key figures, interviewing just people on the street, black people and white people. They would record overheard conversations. They filed memos on everything. And these thousands of pages are now at the Amistad Research Center at Tulane University. And I was shocked to find what I believe, and I've conferred with other historians, I believe it's the earliest recorded interview with Rosa Parks. And she tells the story of her arrest a little bit differently. You know, over time, people tend to not just exaggerate their stories, but just polish them a little bit. And in that very first story, she makes it sound as if she didn't necessarily seek that confrontation. But once goaded, she planted herself firmly and was ready. And she had also been in conference with attorney Fred Gray of Montgomery before that moment. And Fred Gray had really helped prepare her for that moment. So it was not so much the spontaneous act that I think many historians have made it out to be. I think it was as you know, in a way that it's really nice because it feels natural. It was a combination of things. It was her, you know, she wasn't just the tired seamstress. She knew where to sit to make the most likely conflict. And then she was prepared if something happened for it to really take her stand.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Now, it was a watershed moment, that Montgomery boycott, for Martin Luther King, because I think it really set him on his path to becoming the figure he was in the civil rights movement. How did MLK Jr. get involved with the Montgomery bus boycott?
This is one of the great quirks of history, and I love it when these things happen, because there's no reason to anticipate that King would become the leader of the boycott. He's new in town. He's still, you know, getting used to his new congregation. He views this as a stepping stone job to a bigger congregation, and then eventually perhaps to a teaching job at a college. And he's got a new baby at home. So he's not looking for this. In fact, Coretta, actually, and King have some long discussions about whether he should even get involved in a leadership position at the NAACP, the local chapter, because their lives are so busy at this moment. But he's asked to be the spokesman, not the leader of the Montgomery Improvement Association. He's just asked to be the spokesman, in part because he's new in town and he hasn't made any enemies yet. And they think that if he's out in front, they won't have to worry about divisions. They won't have to worry about keeping, about some people wanting to sit it out because they don't like the leader. King is a blank slate at that point. And of course, they also know that he has great speaking abilities, and they're looking for somebody who will be able to rally the crowds, because they don't know how long this bus boycott is going to last. It might be one day, it might be 2 days. And of course, it turns out to be a whole year. So King is thrown into this with little warning. And he's asked to speak on December 5th, 1955 at Holt Street Baptist Church to a crowd of thousands that are just waiting to be told, you know, what happens now. And that speech is really the one that launches him. That's the first time that most people in Montgomery have heard his voice. And his power to move a crowd, it's just amazing. And it's like a star is born in that moment. And he's the perfect man for this moment. And, you know, we'll find out why in the days ahead.
Yeah. Say more about that.
Well, nobody's really thought yet about the impact of Northern media, about television. You know, television is still a fairly new phenomenon. It's rare to see TV news crews showing up in places, you know, outside the studio. You don't have a lot of TV news cameras, but all that's changing. And King is this incredibly telegenic, incredibly gifted speaker who's educated in the North. So the Northern media, when they discover this guy, they fall in love with him. They can't get enough. And suddenly you've got this guy who's clearly smarter and better educated than the white people he's tussling with, who are trying to defend segregation. And it becomes this irresistible story that lights up the nation. You know, he's soon on the cover of Time magazine. He's soon being seen as the most prominent Black leader, and certainly at least, you know, in the young Black leader in the country. And that could not have happened. And the fact that he's a preacher, too, which gives him this also this great moral authority. It's like he's, you know, central casting could not have come up with a better man for that moment.
Now, he himself called the speech that he gave there the most decisive speech of his life. Why did he call it that?
Well, he suffered a panic attack in the moments before the speech. You know, he usually took hours, sometimes days, to prepare a sermon. And now he had about 20 minutes to get ready for this speech. And he felt like God spoke to him in that moment, that God told him to just trust in God and to let God speak for him. And that speech, he found his voice. He found not just his position as a leader. He not just, you know, embraced that challenge, but he found that everything that he had been taught at home, at Morehouse, where Black pride was emphasized, perhaps, you know, more strongly than any college in the country, at seminary, studying in the racist, you know, North, everything coalesced in that moment. And he gave this speech that rallied the people behind the forces of the Constitution, the forces of the Bible, nonviolence. He said, we're going to protest this unfair system by proving that we're better than them, by proving that we don't want to tear down the system. We want to make the system fair. We want to join the system after we make it fair. You know, that was the message that he would deliver for the rest of his life, that he would continue to call on the Constitution, to call on the Bible, to summon our higher moral values in pursuit of a better society. And I think that's what he meant when he said that was the defining moment for him.
Yeah, and talk a little bit more about his commitment to nonviolence, what it meant for him, because he came under attack by a lot of other Black leaders, I mean, including, of course, Malcolm X, most notably, for not being militant enough. But he argued that nonviolence came out of strength, not weakness.
Absolutely. And I should say he was criticized on both sides. Some people thought this nonviolence stuff was a bunch of hooey, that it was really just a strategic move for him, that he didn't really believe it. And then you had people like Malcolm X saying, you know, hell no, if you hit me, I'm going to hit you back. And Americans, you know, white Americans are never going to respect us if we keep turning the other cheek. So, you know, King, as usual, found himself stuck in the middle. But this goes back to, you know, what the core of everything he says and does is rooted in the Bible, is rooted in the teachings of Jesus Christ. And he, you know, nonviolence is right there. It takes him a little while to get the hang of it in a way, because, you know, when Bayard Rustin comes to Montgomery and sees that King has a gun, he says, you know, we might need to work on your nonviolence tactics. You got to get rid of the gun. You got to get rid of the armed men in front of your house if you want to preach nonviolence. And King realizes, too, there is a strategic advantage to it, because it really emphasizes the again, as I said, that higher moral values, that we're going to go high here. We're going to teach the Bull Connors of the world, the mayors and the sheriffs of the South, that that there's power in restraint, that we are going to appeal to the masses. We're going to get the sympathy of the nation by showing that we're willing to suffer for what we believe. And as King often said, you know, suffering is a redemptive, that there's a chance to really show the world through our suffering just how great our capacity for love really is.
This is some of the this really struck me throughout the book, that he seemed to have a genuine optimism about human nature, a genuine optimism that his movement could bring about the beloved community that he spoke about. And, you know, now we are in an age of the new Jim Crow, of incredible backlash, of just the undoing of the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, rather. So as you saw this, as you were writing about this, from this vantage point, what were you thinking as you explored this idea of his optimism about human beings?
Yeah, on the one hand, I was deeply moved by his unending hope that we can be better people, that we can be a better society, that we can not just be a better country, but a better world. He never lost that hope, in spite of the fact that, you know, people were bombing his home and literally stabbing him in the chest. He continued to believe that love was a great enough force to turn everyone around, even his most vicious enemies. I love when when J. Edgar Hoover called him, a liar and a threat to, American society, that King's response was, the FBI director must be under terrible strain to say something like that. You know, he I'm sure he felt anger, but he was not going to let Hoover get the best of him. He was going to show compassion. And as much as that inspired me to answer the second half of your question, it was disturbing to see how that moment of hope when this country seemed to embrace a truly moral leader has crashed and burned so badly that we are living in a society where, so many of the things he warned about have come true, that our, income inequality is greater. We're still living in segregated societies with segregated schools and segregated housing. And, we still have police brutality aimed specifically at Black people. We still have, mass incarceration in which, Black people are disproportionately affected. So, that's the sad shadow of this story.
Yeah, I mean, it really is a case. There was a moment of hope that I really had in 2020 when so many people came together. And of course, that engendered such a fierce white supremacist backlash that I actually began to think, as reading your book, that maybe we are the ones who are wrong not to have that optimism. That in a way, King really did see into the heart of what could be. It's just that the forces of reaction, maybe of a minority, are really powerful.
Well, there's no question about it. And unfortunately, in the case of King, our government was stoking those forces of hostility. They were afraid of change. They were afraid of radical voices. That's human nature too, is to try to cling to power. And, when white society has the power, they're reluctant to share it, even in the spirit of democracy. So, it was painful to watch, and it's painful to watch today. But I like to think that, as you said, that King can still give us hope that he moved us to as close as we've ever come, I suspect, to getting past some of this country's sins of slavery and racism. And maybe that we should, we need to hold out hope that we can make that kind of progress again, and got to keep working on it.
Yeah. And he certainly inspired my family. In fact, my father, Rabbi Martin Friedman, he was my stepfather, was a freedom writer who helped to organize the Clergyman Freedom Ride in June of 1961 with his friend Rabbi Israel Dresner. Mm-hmm. And reading your book, I had to go to the internet to see if there was anything about it. And I uncovered all this material in an interview with my stepfather. I mean, he's been dead now for well over 10 years. And what struck me in that interview, when you talk about the forces of reaction, was how much violence and threat and terror that he faced as a freedom rider, reading about the incredible terror, the implacable violence over and over again, not just against people in the civil rights movement in general, but Martin Luther King and his family, and then hearing it in my own family, it just brought it closer and closer to home to realize just the incredible terror that has been there all along for people who seek to change things. So he had, Martin Luther King Jr. had a very particular attitude. You mentioned it before, that suffering led to redemption. He also applied that to the terror that he experienced in his life. I mean, the incessant attacks, the incessant death threats. I mean, he was stabbed, it was Christ-like, you know, in certain ways. Talk about how he grappled with that, how he coped with it. I mean, I know there were many times when he didn't cope, but he also did cope with it. Talk about how he wrestled and found comfort.
Yeah, he woke up every day knowing that this could be his last, because it was not paranoid. When you have enough threats on your life and you're getting, you know, routine warnings that someone's coming for you, you know, you learn to live with that, I guess, but not comfortably. There's this fabulous, unbelievable piece of footage. A film crew just before King was assassinated is getting with him on a small private plane, just King and three or four other people. And, you know, the camera crew is behind King and looking over his shoulder. And he's talking to Bernard Lee and saying, you know, I don't know who asked, somebody must have said, what's the most scared you've ever been? And he starts, you know, just sort of chuckling about it and comparing these different moments when, you know, he felt like this is it. You know, one of them was in Philadelphia, Mississippi, where the people who killed Goodman, Schwerner, and Cheney were standing behind him and you know, muttering, "You're next," you know, and he felt like, oh, that was it. And here he is on this plane with his pals, you know, saying, "Yeah, I really thought that was it. I thought that's, I'm coming, you know, Lord, this is," you know, and he's talking about it as if he's talking about, you know, last night's baseball game or something. So to live with that day in and day out, you know, we can't imagine the toll that took. We do know that he was hospitalized many times for exhaustion, and Coretta used the word depression to describe it. And that toward the end of his life, you know, many of his friends thought that he was, you know, seriously, you know, clinically depressed, at it, that he needed, if, you know, some people suggested medication. He was afraid that if he were to accept the prescription for some kind of medication, that the FBI would learn about it and would use that to further attempt to destroy his reputation. And he also had to wake up every morning knowing that that could be the day that some newspaper reporter decided to print the rumors that the FBI was leaking about him, to print the details of his sex life, or, you know, any of the other scandals that the FBI was promoting. So I can't even begin to imagine, you know, living under that kind of strain. And that's why, you know, you look at pictures of him and you think he looks 10, 15 years older than he really is.
Jonathan Eich talking about his brilliant new biography of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. It's called King, A Life. Stay tuned for more after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Go to writersvoice.net to find more great content, including web-only features like interview transcripts and extended interviews. Let's get back to our conversation with Jonathan Eich, talking about his biography of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., King, A Life. It's the first major biography of King in 40 years, based on hundreds of interviews and thousands of newly discovered documents. Well, let's talk a little bit about his relationship to women, which we've, you know, alluded to already. I mean, I have to say it shocked me. You know, I know he was a product of his time, but I was really struck that someone of his sensitivity to injustice would be so unjust to his wife, cruel to her as well. It wasn't just the infidelity, and it wasn't only his wife. You know, his attitude towards female leadership, including Rosa Parks. So talk about this and kind of your own feelings as you, you know, read these accounts of the FBI. The FBI, of course, you know, wiretapped him everywhere, and Hoover was obsessed with him and went to the press, tried to peddle these stories to the press constantly, and none of them picked up on it. So pick that one apart for us.
Yeah, it was difficult, and I'm sure it will be for readers to see such a deep flaw in a man. We all have our flaws, And King, you know, was criticized for this in his time by some of the women in his circle, saying that he did not respect women, that he did not give them a chance to serve as leaders within the movement. And some of that was clearly a cultural bias. And that was common, not to excuse it, but it was common not just in that age, but it was common among Baptist preachers in particular. And the SCLC was deeply, you know, was led primarily by Baptist preachers. So that worked against him too. But then there's the issue of King's personal treatment of women and his treatment of his wife. And these are difficult things to reckon with. And we have to just do our best to try to make sense of his flaws, but also recognize that what may be most important about his flaws is the way they were weaponized by the FBI. And, you know, his treatment of women and his treatment of Coretta helps us understand him personally better. But the idea that, you know, our government would seize on that in an attempt to destroy someone who was still one of our great moral leaders, that they would seize on this as a way to try to maintain, you know, white nationalism, as I think that's the way that, you know, J. Edgar Hoover probably saw it, that's to me the bigger story.
Yeah, and it wasn't just J. Edgar Hoover wasn't just some force acting on his own. He was aided and abetted by Robert F. Kennedy and John F. Kennedy and even LBJ. I mean, what really struck me is, you know, LBJ could have a conversation with Martin Luther King that was friendly and supportive on the one hand, and on the other hand, you know, he never put a stop to Hoover's persecution of Martin Luther King.
No, it's worse than that. I think, you know, as you said, LBJ, RFK, JFK, the news media, they were all complicit. And LBJ in particular, I think, had an opportunity to snuff it out. He, you know, when he takes office in particular, he can do whatever he wants. He's friends with J. Edgar Hoover. He could have called Hoover off. He could have even, you know, fired Hoover. Hoover had reached the mandatory age for retirement, and LBJ had an opportunity. He certainly had enough, you know, coming in, filling in for JFK. He could have done whatever he wanted. The public would have supported him. He could have forced his retirement. But in fact, LBJ was not just complicit. He was encouraging this behavior. He was encouraging the wiretaps on King. He seemed to revel in the gossip, in having information on King. And I think he even enjoyed the tawdry stuff. I think he found it, you know, found it fun to read about King's, you know, private exploits. And that's one of the real tragedies here too, because that could have been, and it was, a great relationship. It was a very productive relationship between the president and King. But think how much more productive it might have been. Think how much, you know, LBJ might have changed society for the better if he hadn't, you know, really turned his back on King.
And yet he did accomplish a lot. I mean, the Voting Rights Act was a profound change. I mean, King himself wept when he, you know, I mean, wept with tears of joy when he watched the signing of that act.
No question about it. And I would make the case that it was the most productive relationship between a president and a protest leader in American history. And they, both men deserve enormous credit for what they achieved. But at the same time, they had similar ambitions going forward. They both had the goal of eradicating poverty. But the relationship was tainted in part by the FBI's activities, but also by King's refusal to endorse or to remain silent about the Vietnam War. So that was really the undoing in a way too, because LBJ was obsessed with the war. He was driven mad by it in a sense, and he became infuriated that King criticized him. And King felt like it was if King were more of a politician, maybe he would have seen that pragmatic choice would be not to speak out on the war, but he was not a politician. He was a religious leader. And that meant that he had to follow his beliefs. And obviously he couldn't call out violence in the South. He couldn't call out violence in American cities where there were, you know, racial uprisings and police brutality. He couldn't call that out and then remain silent on Vietnam. That was just never going to happen.
It's always been interesting to me that, you know, Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr., who had so many disagreements during their lives, seemed certainly toward the end of Malcolm's life, and before that, I think for Martin Luther King, came to understand the necessity for a fight that went beyond civil rights. It went beyond ending, you know, systemic racism in this country. I wonder if you could talk more about that and why both leaders, you know, I mean, I'm asking you about Malcolm X. You haven't written a book about him. But why do you think that that seemed to be the place that they were both tending toward?
Well, King, against the advice of his advisors, felt like it was hypocritical to ignore the prejudice, the discrimination, the segregation of the North. And it was hypocritical to attack, you know, violence in the South, but not to attack, you know, the violence in the North and in Vietnam. And, you know, he really felt like he needed to follow the course of his true religious beliefs. And in that way, he and Malcolm were aligned. They certainly disagreed on tactics, and they proved to be useful foils for one another at times. You know, Malcolm, I think, recognized that criticizing King was good for his audiences liked that, that he benefited from being seen as the scarier of the two. But they really found themselves with much more in common as the years went by. And, you know, James Baldwin wrote that by the end of both of their lives, they had much more in common than they did in difference. So I think that had both of them lived, we might have seen a lot more cooperation. We certainly would have seen a lot more shared values and possibly shared tactics. And some of this, too, is the media, you know, trying to set them up as rivals, trying to, you know, create a sense of conflict within the movement. You know, King really looked for common ground. He found ways to work with Stokely Carmichael. He found reasons to praise Malcolm X. He was somebody who really just wanted to, you know, build a broad coalition. But the white media often didn't want to see it that way or didn't want to portray it that way.
This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're spending the hour with Jonathan Eig talking about his brilliant new biography of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. It's called King, A Life. And you said that he struggled with the kind of issue of militancy versus moderation. I mean, I'm not, you know, maybe there's not even a versus there. There's not necessarily a contradiction. Could you talk more about his personal struggles over militancy and moderation, how he struck the balance and why?
Well, King said often that, you know, don't confuse pacifism with weakness. He believed, as Jesus taught, that the great strength is in turning the other cheek, in extending a hand, in showing love for your enemy. That takes a kind of strength that you know, more militant people maybe can't even begin to imagine. That I think that King really, it's funny because, you know, he loved people so much that he often had a hard time with conflict. You know, he didn't like to fire anybody. He didn't like to publicly disagree with people like Bayard Rustin or with the NAACP leaders. That he avoided conflict at all costs, which is, you know, just funny given his line of work.
Yeah, you know, I recently learned that King was a democratic socialist. You say in the book that in Halloween King, we've hollowed him. And you said right up at the front of this interview that he was a lot more radical than, you know, he's given credit for in by our culture. What did democratic socialism mean for him? I mean, he wasn't a communist. He wasn't pro-communist, even though Hoover tried to tar him with that brush.
King believed in the power of government to take care of people, to do things that charities were never going to be able to accomplish. You know, he looked at some of the European democracies and saw, you know, programs that provided much more support than we do here in America. You know, and we're still talking about some of those issues. We're still talking about guaranteed income, guaranteed employment, you know, universal health care. These are not you know, bizarre ideas. They were, many of them, he saw them working in Europe, and he thought the same could work here. And in fact, you know, LBJ and Richard Nixon subsequently endorsed many of these ideas. Nixon explored the idea of guaranteed income, and we're still talking today. And I think some cities have now begun experimenting with guaranteed minimum incomes. So, you know, it was progressive, but it was certainly not communist, and it was certainly not, you know, un-American in any way.
I'd like to talk a little bit more about Coretta King, to go back with her and give her her due. Because on the one hand, she seems to have never really accepted the truth of his being unfaithful to her. Whether that's really true or not, at least that's what she said. But she played she gave up a lot to be his wife. But she also was absolutely key, not just in the beginning, but all the way through. So talk about how she kept him going when he was tempted to give up, just the role that she played in his life.
In one interview after another, and in all of her books, and in some of these, I found some tapes of hers that she had recorded while writing her first memoir. She says over and over, and this too, I accepted. That's like one of her favorite lines. And this too, I accepted. Because when she met Martin, as she called him, she had, you know, enormous ambitions to be a concert singer, to be active in the civil rights movement, to perhaps use her concert singing to raise awareness in the way that people like Marian Anderson and Mahalia Jackson had done. And she, like a lot of women, wrestled with when marriage came along, you know, what do you do with those ambitions? And that was something that Betty Friedan wrote about at that exact moment in history, in the Feminine Mystique. So, you know, a lot of women were grappling with this, but she had to grapple with it more publicly than most women, because, you know, her husband was famous, and she was being asked how it felt to be the wife of Martin Luther King Jr. And over again, she had to talk about how, you know, her own ambitions had to take a back seat. And then, of course, you know, she confronted her husband about it and said, I want to be more involved. I want to be out there with you. I want to be out there speaking in places where you can't get to. You can't be every place at once. And he resisted that. He wanted her home with the children. And this was, you know, I think mostly just a result of his old fashioned values and his inability to really think progressively in this one department. You know, he was obviously a progressive thinker in most ways, but this was a blind spot for him. And she struggled with it terribly, and yet, you know, really maintained her dignity and never let the public see just how difficult this was for her. And she, you know, she wrote about it years later, and she described this one conversation that's really painful, where she's beseeching him to let me do more, and he's saying flatly, "No, it's not going to happen." And you know, your heart breaks for her, really.
Yes. Yes, it did. Now, she wrote an essay for a magazine for Black women after Martin Luther King's murder, in which she said that women have been the backbone of the civil rights movement. And then in the following paragraph, you just list exactly what she meant by that. Tell us some of the highlights.
Well, it's absolutely true that, you know, women started a lot of these things, and then men took over and formed the official leadership. But the Montgomery bus boycott began almost entirely because of the work and contributions of women. And in city after city where you see these grassroots efforts beginning, it's almost always beginning with women who are speaking up, organizing. And then when it begins to bubble up and, you know, the city responds or the state responds, then the men come in and take over the negotiations and take over the protests. But, you know, women were out in the fields organizing. They were out in the fields, you know, leading voter registration drives. You know, the civil rights movement is, you know, the soldiers may be a majority female. I wouldn't swear to that, but it certainly feels that way. And Coretta recognized that. In fact, that article that she wrote for New Lady magazine was a very long article. She must have spent a great deal of time writing it, and she actually mailed a copy to Rosa Parks and said, I think you'll enjoy reading this, because there weren't that many people at the time who really took note of the women's contributions.
And now, of course, I mean, we have to mention the assassination. The family has never accepted that it was just the work of a lone gunman. What is your thought about this?
Well, many, many people have looked at this in much greater detail, including congressional committees and writers who I respect, and nobody has found the smoking gun, pardon the expression, to suggest that there was a broader conspiracy. But I do think we know for certain that the FBI created the conditions in which they knew somebody might be propelled to act, to take the law into their own hands. So I feel for the family. I can understand why they refused to believe that James Earl Ray acted alone, but I haven't seen any evidence to support that in any meaningful way. So I don't dive into that too deeply in the book because others, as I said, have looked at it much more closely. And I want to keep the focus on Dr. King and his life and his work. But I do think that what's the important thing to remember here is that our government, the American government, our taxpaying, our tax dollars went toward building a campaign to sow the kind of distrust, to sow the kind of hatred that would might inspire someone to kill Dr. King.
Right. You know, I'm put in mind of the former president, you know, inciting people to go to the Capitol. Only this was a campaign of much longer duration against Martin Luther King. And it is striking, you know, it was just a few weeks after he was assassinated that Robert F. Kennedy was assassinated in the same year of Malcolm X. I mean, it was like the age of assassination. And of course, JFK, it's understandable why people would think it wasn't, you know, that there was some greater plot. So finally, I just wanted to ask you, you know, what were some of your biggest challenges? And you went into this book, it's a long book, a huge amount of research, fascinating on every page. I mean, really, I read it like a novel. It was absolutely wonderful. But for you, what were some of your biggest challenges? And when you went in, did you change at all from the time that you went in to the time you ended? This process of writing it change you?
Well, the challenge in some ways was just grappling with this massive amount of information. That King's life has been very well documented. There have been great books already written. There were huge archival mountains to climb, and there were, you know, new mountains to be discovered and climbed. So processing that amount of information and doing that, you know, traveling the country and doing all of these interviews, that was both, you know, an enormous challenge and just a great joy, because I had, you know, 6 years of full-time work, you know, God only knows how many hours a week devoted to trying to master this one subject. And I should also say that one of the great joys was that I had this incredible support community, these other historians, other writers who helped guide me, and I'm forever grateful to them. I know I could not have done this alone. So the support of King's friends, colleagues, and these scholars, you know, meant everything to me. And that's one of the things I learned from this, because I've written six books. I've never had this level of cooperation. I tended to think that you had to do this work alone. And I found this great, you know, beloved community of people who knew King and cared about him and cared about his story, who wanted to help me get it right. And that was really moving to me. And I hope that I will continue to pay that forward in the years ahead as other people dive into this story.
Mm. Well, that's lovely. And it's just been great to talk with you, Jonathan Eig, about this really wonderful, wonderful biography, King, A Life. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on the show.
But wait, there's more. After the interview, our conversation continued for a few more minutes. Is there anything that you didn't say that you want to say?
And it was fascinating about your stepfather. That was great. I spoke to Rabbi Dressner actually before he passed away, and I got to talk to a few of those rabbis who made that trip. So that was really, really cool.
Oh, that's great. You know, a little story about that. I don't remember this because I was a child, and I don't remember a whole lot about my childhood. But well, I was 12 when he went down. But then it took about 3 years. It went before the Supreme Court. They lost the case on a technicality, and my father had to spend a few days in jail. And the New York Times evidently called the house, and I answered. And the reporter asked, what do you think about your father being in jail? And according to what Martin said, my father, Martin, he said that I told the guy, well, if my father's in jail, it must be because he's doing something good.
Oh, that's awesome. Have you checked the Times archive to see if you can find the story? Did they write anything?
Yeah, that's a great idea. I will do that.
I wonder if they maybe they didn't quote you, but I'll bet if there's a story, it would still be really cool to find it.
And indeed, I did find it. There were two articles in the New York Times about the Freedom Riders that my stepfather, Martin Friedman, helped organize. Although the articles didn't quote me, I learned new facts about the case. Go to writersvoice.net for links to them and to listen to an excerpt from Jonathan Eig's book, King. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to find more great content, including web-only features like interview transcripts and extended interviews. And listen again for free by signing up for the Writer's Voice podcast on your favorite podcast app.